Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Smith & Jones. Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you. Fresh content every Thursday right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and on your favorite podcast platform, Google, Apple, Spotify, or otherwise. Download, subscribe, rate, and review, and also share it as well. And hopefully you'll be sharing this one as well, as we've got a couple of great guests joining us on the show this week to talk a lot about the NBA postseason. We are right in the thick of it, and I know I speak for Jonesy when I say I wish we were still working. I wish we were still calling games. But here we are sitting back with our feet up, enjoying as fans. And it has been a thrill to start thus far. And I can only anticipate what's going to be coming in rounds two and in the conference finals and beyond. But to discuss one of the bigger and better stories right now, we are pleased to be joined by radio and television broadcaster for the New York Knicks, Monica McNutt.
Monica, the Knicks have had a terrific year. I guess around the expectations, I mean, New York always wants it all of it. If they don't get to a conference final or the NBA final or something along those lofty heights, how will New Yorkers view this season?
I hope, Jonesy, that the rational side of New Yorkers and Knicks fans can prevail and they can say Julius Randle got hurt and Jalen Brunson carried this team to heights that we had not anticipated, right? I'm sitting here with you from Philadelphia on the precipice of Game 3, and I know that enthusiasm and energy is at an all-time high. And there's a very legitimate path that I think fans are believing in to get to that place. But if it were to come up short, I would hope that they would reflect on an incredible season. And frankly, how much of a destination that this New York Knicks organization and team could potentially be when you start talking about agents or missing pieces.
Monica, to that point, how important is it? It's not your job. I don't even know that it's management's job. I speak for a living. to temper the expectations of the fan base that clearly wants to win, that's clearly starving for wins and something of relevancy, as opposed to just taking that step back and saying, yeah, but we understand this is a process. We've been waiting. And they were good last year. They got better this year. And you know what? It might be next year. It might be the year after. And being relevant year after year and being good year after year is also a pretty damn good thing, as opposed to, no, I want it all and I want it now.
And that's tough, right? You nailed it. Exactly. That's tough. Like, can you appreciate the growth and also not be deterred by how much further you have to go, right? But I think, guys, and before we hop on this call, we kind of reflected on what you guys experienced in Toronto in 2019, right? Like, I do not think that fans should lose how hard it is to win. Oh. And I give the Knicks fans a ton of credit, right? Like, they have been through the highs, lows, in between, been the laughingstock, been a relevant franchise, fought for respect the whole bit. And so I certainly understand feeling like we are as close as we've ever been. In fact, after the finish on Tuesday night, I'm sitting with some of my colleagues at MSG Network and my buddy Jeff Johnson. He's like, this doesn't happen to the Knicks. Like, Reggie Miller happened to us. Like, yeah. These types of things don't happen to break this way for us to finish and be on top, right? And so I think clearing that sentiment, but I also look at this team, though, guys, and if ever there was an opportunity for a city and its fan base to take its cues from its leadership in terms of head coach Tom Thibodeau, an all-star and all-NBA point guard, should be all-NBA this year, Jalen Brunson, right? They are guys that, as they say, are going to chop wood and carry water. And so you really have to respect each step of the process. And more times than not, you'll be at a podium with either one of those guys, and they're like, I know this sounds cliche, but it's true. One game at a time, right? Like, one decision at a time. And this organization is moving forward. You have to stand and enjoy that. And then kind of let the chips fall where they may. And I know that's not easy.
Yeah, no. Monica, we hear you. Listen, Eric and I were in the building when Kawhi's shot hit every part of the rim at the York Street end of Scotiabank or Air Canada Center at the time. And it was unreal. And everybody remembers that shot. And if that shot goes another way, maybe they lose in overtime to Philadelphia, and we're not talking about any of this. And, you know, Kevin Durant does the Achilles, and Klay Thompson does an ACL. And, like, there are so many things that happen. I mean, Kawhi only plays 60 games, but he gets all 24 in the playoffs. And trust me, we could see at times he was laboring. And so it is, there is some luck. There is a fine line. And you just talked about the finish of game two. How improbable is that? Because we said the same thing in Toronto when Kawhi's shot went down. Mm-hmm. Well, you mean we get to have nice things too? Like that really happens. But to your point about Tibbs and Brunson and their steadfast nose to the grind mentality, I just don't think that they would have taken even the loss in game two any other way that, all right, let's go back and get the next one.
I mean, Jonesy, listen, and the clip now has done incredible numbers of my radio partner, Pat O'Keefe, and I reacting down the stretch. I was like, in my head, like, all right, cool, tie ball game. Like, this is the way series go. They say series don't start until the road team wins a game. Cool, right? But I think as important as the shot that Jalen, like Kawhi Leonard, gets every part of the rim and finally gets a home bounce, before that, there's a loose ball. Yeah. And the Knicks are just faster to that loose ball. Dante DiVincenzo is in there scooping up that ball before the Sixers guys are even fully into a reach to get the basketball, right? And so there was just an urgency down the stretch. And I give Jalen Brunson a ton of credit. This is the one thing, Jonesy and Eric, you guys have been in media for a long time, so you know, I really wish I could have taken this back on the clip that sort of went viral. He had a terrible shooting night. But overall, he's playing smart basketball, right? And I literally was at a loss for words as this thing is unfolding. So the confidence, right, each play, each shot, chop wood, carry water, for Jalen Brunson to tee up that jump shot again in that moment and finally get the bounce. And then the wherewithal to not just, y'all know as a hooper, oh, I finally got one in.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Just kind of the release of that. But then to stay locked in and turn back around, and he and Josh Hart are involved in this double team, and I understand the last two-minute report. I don't want to take anything away from it. But in the moment, the mindfulness of, okay, let's get this basketball because now it's a two-point ball game. We have life again, right? And so the way the whole thing unfolds, it is truly a testament to the grit of this team. I've been reading articles here in Philadelphia, and I apologize that I can't think of the writer, but she wrote one of the differences in her mind in this series is that everybody on the Knicks roster has made their impact be felt. And the role players for the Sixers, that's not the case. But that last 27.4 second stretch, y'all, embodies that.
Yeah.
DiVincenzo picks up the loose ball. Jalen Brunson finally hits a shot. Josh Hart all over the place forces a steal. DiVincenzo takes another three. He's been terrific from three all season. Isaiah Hartenstein, monster rebound. OG Anunoby, heads up pass.
Swing
back
the ball.
To DiVincenzo.
Yeah.
Like
yep.
All five guys on the floor are involved in the game altering play down the stretch. And so it is something that I will certainly never forget. I think Knicks fans have it ranked third in terms of all time moments in Knicks history based on, I think that was a column out of the New York Post that came out over since the game went final. It's just been incredible, y'all.
Yeah, I mean, it's only happened three times in that situation in the playoffs that a team has won when being down at that point in the game. Is there anything coming when you look at it? Because, Monica, as you said, we've been on the other side. We don't have the nice things. It never happens to us.
Mm-hmm.
What is the prevailing attitude coming out of Philadelphia? And do they... I'm sure they're going to play a little bit angry, a little bit mad tonight. And can the Knicks, do they have the type of player that's going to have them play in a sense that they're not playing like they're up 2-0 and they still have home court?
Okay, so first part of that question, of course, Philly is hot. Philly is pissed. Apparently, and I only learned this today, guys, after media availability at shoot-around. There's also now a divide between Philadelphia and Villanova over this play.
Yes, I heard about that. Posting the clips of Hart, Brunson, and DiVincenzo, how well. And
the
Philly fans are like, what are you doing? It's like, well, wait a minute, it's Villanova. No, we don't want to hear that.
Yeah, so this has been a little bit divisive. So anyway, Philly fans are pissed. And as I will say, in the moment, we didn't have the best angle. I did not see fouls, but obviously I'm not going to argue with the last two-minute report, right? But I also think, and I don't mean this flippantly, the Knicks they filed a grievance this year. They've had calls not go their way. I think that is not unfamiliar to the league this season. And to me, I'm going to chalk it up to a little bit of home court advantage, right? But I'm not taking away that there probably should have been some whistles on that play. But here we are. So So I do think Philadelphia is pissed. You all heard the sound from Joel Embiid post-game. I think the sound would have hit a little bit different if he was making eye contact and not picking through his hair. But that's neither here nor there. Nick Nurse is a great coach. And Tyrese Maxey and Joel Embiid, arguably, for at least three quarters, were the best players on the floor in that second game as well. And so you can't deny the talent there. Now, when it comes to the Knicks, I do think that there is a confidence that you cannot quantify when it comes to the statistics that this team is dealing with. And I was thinking about this today, y'all. When Julius Randle goes down at the end of January after a monster month, like you talk about the Knicks fans being riding high right now after game two, in January you can tell the Knicks fans nothing. And that was before the national conversation had sort of turned, right? Then Julius Randle gets hurt, OG Anunoby is out, and then you're looking at a team that's basically 500 over the stretch to finish the season, as those two guys are now, obviously Randle's unavailable and OG Anunoby works himself back. But during that stretch, and you could even actually go back to Mitchell Robinson going down, Coach Tom Thibodeau, frankly, is forced to go deeper into his rotations than I think he would have if all those guys are healthy. And so now, with the acquisitions, Bogdanovich finally finding his rhythm, Isaiah Hartenstein having a monster season emerging as a starter, Deuce McBride having to fill in spot minutes as a starter, incredible confidence, Josh Hart having to be your do-it-all and really being able to grow in that role, there is an understanding that for this team, like I said in the clip, they're going to find a way, right? Candidly, if they drop tonight, I tip my cap to Philly because that is a formidable opponent there. But I am fairly confident that they're going to split this thing here in Philadelphia because of the mentality and the grit that they play with. Not because they are, you know what I'm saying, not necessarily the better team on paper, but there's something that you just can't kind of quantify statistically. You have to be there to really understand what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Monica, I don't know that this is fair. Jonesy and I have talked a lot about this over the years. Again, I don't mean to keep referencing 5 years ago, but it was still a story 5 years ago. Joel Embiid is an unbelievable talent, and there's no denying that he is playing on maybe one leg, one and a half at best right now. But that said, and I'm not trying to be a hater here, he's got to show me something still. Like, for as good as he is, you know, MVP, and putting up incredible numbers, and he's an all-world talent and everything else. It's been a long time dealing with trust the process, and okay, now we've trusted the process, and now they're a winning team, but they haven't tasted playoff success. And I found it, I'm just going to use the word rich. I found it very rich after game two when the guy who's been uber critical about Nick Nurse for years is now defending Nick Nurse and backing Nick Nurse because, well, yeah, of course, that's his coach now. And that's like, be careful what you say about anybody or anything because it might come round where that's your teammate, that's your coach one day. And I just, I'm at the point with Embiid where it's like, man, I need to see you in a conference finals. I need to see you in an NBA finals, let alone winning a chip, if you're going to keep talking the way you talk.
Trust the process, E.
Listen, E, you're not, I completely understand your sentiment, E. And Jones, you messed up for chiming in with that. What I will say is this year, I do have compassion for Joel Embiid more than I think I ever have, right?
Okay.
We all know health is wealth when you talk about sports and just in general for our lives, right? Like health is wealth. Now, it does feel almost scripted that the clock strikes playoffs. And there's a health issue in Philadelphia. This year was not that, in that he was dealing with this knee injury further out. And I can remember y'all being on Get Up, and when the matchup looked like it was going to be Philly and Milwaukee, I said that I think Joel Embiid has grown this point in his life as a man and as an athlete. He's a husband. He's a dad now. He's been so close. I'm sure he knows that he's never gotten past the second round. I think that there's something different about him and that he's willing to push through this injury to the best of his ability. Now that they're facing Knicks, I still feel the same way, but I think that injury may have been a little bit underestimated when dealing with a team as physical as the New York Knicks. But I don't think you're wrong in having that sentiment, E, because he is the leader. And frankly, we're watching the game. He's not jumping and he's not explosive. But when he needed to get in there and get rebounds, at least through three quarters, he did have his quick twitch in spots. He still got to the free throw line. He put up 35 and 10. Now, if we dig a little bit deeper, the impactful fourth quarter presence was maybe not there down the stretch. But I think we all are watching him drag his knee, right? And so if he was healthy, they probably wouldn't be playing the Knicks because you're talking about them being a one or two seed, right?
Yeah.
And I think the entire basketball world would have really enjoyed that opportunity. But here we are, and you got to play the cards that you've been dealt. So I go back to something that we kind of discussed in New York early this season, this idea of just some guys are winners, right? And I don't think that there's winners and losers. I personally don't think it's necessarily binary in that way. But some guys do have the winning DNA. And when you look at a Jalen Brunson, who has always been underrated, but you look at every stop of his basketball career, he's won. And that builds something. Again, put an asterisk on health, but I think as we have this conversation, Joel Embiid, health has always been there. And in contrast for the Knicks, there's always been a piece of winning DNA when it comes to Jalen Brunson.
And I just want to say, before I hand the baton back to Jonesy here, for what it's worth, before I get any haters or whatever, and Monica, sorry, I picked Philly to win the series. It's online. It's there for anybody to see. I might, hey, maybe I'm proven right still. Maybe I'm proven dead wrong the way the Knicks are playing right now. But I thought because of Randle being out, even with Embiid not at 100%, I thought that might swing the series. I picked the Sixers to win, not even in seven. I picked them to win in six. So they got to reel off a bunch of wins now if they're going to make me look right. So I'm not hating on the guy. I believed in Philly. I'm getting a little bit tired, I suppose, of hearing similar things year after year. But you said it well, yeah. The compassion that you have for what he dealt with this year and still battling through, you're bang on with that, no doubt.
No, I look at this series, it could easily be 1-1. It could easily be 2-0 Philly. I mean, it's been that close. And
it was close, yeah.
And that's how the playoffs go. And you need to make a play, you make a play, and so it goes. Monica, one of the things for me that I've always considered, and I'm old school, I'm from maybe a different generation, and the Athletic had this foolish, in my eyes, anonymous poll. Like Eric and I, if you don't put your name on something on social media, we don't answer. I'm not talking to no keyboard warrior that's got some anonymous and, you know, a picture of a phone or something. No. I put my name on stuff. There's a blue check mark there. You know where to find me. So in this anonymous poll, they talk about Tibbs being one of the coaches they'd least like to play for. And I found it interesting that some of the guys that players of this generation least wanted to play for were guys that are, I guess, of my generation, the type that are true straight up coaches. They're going to coach you. This is not, if you want feelings and you want hugs, then you have somebody else in your life for that. I'm going to coach you. I'm going to get what we need to do done to win. And if you're part of that, and Doc Rivers always said it, he was another guy on that list. Good players want to be coached. So I just your thoughts on Tibbs, because I'm a Tibbs fan. I the guy just loves the game. And as you said, chop wood, carry water. Man, that guy is grinding like night to day.
100%. Here's what I will say to that, Josie. It's so funny. Can you be in relationships with people if you don't want all of them? I'm taking this way off of, like, slightly off of basketball. But hear me out, right? Like, I imagine that some of that poll is maybe part of also what makes head coach Tom Thibodeau great, right? He is incessant. He is relentless. Basketball is the thing. And I do wonder if this generation of athletes is looking for maybe a little bit more of a well-rounded leader. I'm not sure. This is all me hypothesizing with you guys, right? But to me, to your point, if you're trying to win, if you are trying to be above and beyond when it comes to preparation, if you're trying to have a guy that can help you grow, that best understands the scouting report and how to win basketball games, you want to play for head coach Tom Thibodeau, right? But not everybody wants to work that hard.
Right.
It's sort of a running joke around here with the Knicks about, like, off days. I'm not saying that they don't take them, but, like, the gym is always open and things are optional, right? And so I just think some guys don't want to work that hard. Some people rank balance, you know what I'm saying? Whatever that means to them, right? And I am very much, even, you know, for us as broadcasters, we enjoy what we do, but, like, the grind is real in terms of our travel as well, right? I look at it as, like, seasonal. Either you're in the season to grind and to win and to get better, or you're not, right?
Yeah.
And so as much as that poll made waves, you also had the Knicks guys absolutely defending their head coach,
yeah,
right? Like,
yeah.
I don't know who y'all are talking about.
But,
and so I did think that was interesting because I'm not sure who was the one that they wanted to play for the most.
Like, I don't know.
Who's at the top of the list?
You look at that list, Monica, of guys that they didn't want to play for, and all those guys are successful. Tibbs, Doc, Nick Nurse, like nobody wants to play for these guys. Well, then you don't want to win. And to me, it's not all roses and cherries. If you want green grass, you're going to have some rain, and that's the way it goes. So I'm okay with
100%.
I'm okay with, you know, as Eric says, we always laugh about it on the broadcast. Tibbs sounds like he gargles with glass, man, but he's grinding it. And Doc, and I mean, we had Nick Nurse here for 10 years, 5 as a head coach. And these guys are passionate about what they do, and they're always thinking the game. And if you want something else, then maybe basketball is not for you, or maybe pro basketball, like you said, you don't want to work that hard and it's not for you. I just found that interesting. And here's Tibbs up 2-0 on another guy that people didn't want to play for, Nick Nurse, and they're both, you know, this close to each other in that series.
I'm with you. It was funny, not funny, but sort of ironic. All of this, everything will be made of the last 2-minute report. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Great, great, great. But I think we forget, like, the game didn't actually stop there, right? And you've got the block by Isaiah Hartenstein. And then after that, you've got Isaiah Hartenstein switched on to Tyrese Maxey, forcing mm-hmm. Joel Embiid to take that last three for the opportunity. I think at that point, it would have tied the ball game.
Yeah.
But we asked Isaiah Hartenstein post game after Pat and I composed ourselves. And yeah, he talked about, you know, not many teams probably would have actually believed that they still had a chance to win. But we even asked him about the final play, right? Like, not the block, but the final play. And he's like, we know exactly what they were going to do. Head coach Tom, you know, Tibbs had been preparing us for that in the timeout. Like, we've worked on it before we got to that moment. And so the preparation shines through. And so I do expect a very passionate and focused Philadelphia team and, of course, Philadelphia crowd when we get to game action tonight. But I do not blame the last 2-minute report for the reason that they lost that basketball game.
Monica, last one for you. There's no way for you to answer this with any certainty, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Would the Knicks still be where they are? Would they be in a better position, a worse position, the same position if they hadn't made that deal? Because there's no denying that OG, when healthy, has been absolutely outstanding for them. But that was a ballsy trade to make on top of it when you're giving up a starter and your sixth man, like a key cog in your rotation in a essentially, we thought at first a 2-for-1 deal, but of course Precious ended up being a pretty good piece at times as well. But, you know, to give up 2 major pieces, that took nerve to make that move.
I thought you were going somewhere else, E, and I was going to be like, get out of my head this morning. Oh my God. But you pivoted a little bit. Let me just say this. I adore Emmanuel Quickley and RJ Barrett. Emmanuel Quickley is a starting point guard in this league. Emmanuel Quickley was never going to start over Jalen Brunson. Not going to happen, right? RJ Barrett, incredible young man. Heart still goes out to his family as they are navigating the loss of his brother. But RJ Barrett is a better freelancer than Tibbs' system was ever going to give him an opportunity
mm-hmm.
to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes, guys, and this is a hard lesson to swallow as we grow up, right? They don't teach us this one in kindergarten. But fit can be a neutral thing, and a yes or a no is not bad. So I think both of those guys were free to go to positions where they can flourish, and the trade certainly worked out for the Knicks. And so is this team here without that trade? I really don't know, E, because RJ is not the defender that OG is, and he frankly is not content waiting in the corner and then cutting off the basketball,
mm-hmm.
right? He did not complement this roster the way that OG has. And Precious has had some really great games, and he's brought some energy in some other games, right? And so in totality, if you look at the trade with Toronto as the domino that then moves Bojan Bogdanović to the Knicks also, who has mastered in the last dozen games or so how to be impactful in a short amount of time, I think that trade was the exact right thing that needed to be done. And I think that it certainly has buoyed this team to this point.
Monica, we appreciate the time today. This was awesome. And enjoy the series. And hopefully it's a good long run in the postseason. Hopefully we're talking to you again in June at some point.
I like the sound of that, guys. Thanks for having me.
All right, Monica.
That was Monica McNutt from the New York Knicks broadcast doing radio and TV. She does a fabulous job, and we appreciate her taking the time joining us on Smith and Jones. When we continue, we are going to hook up with a friend of the show, though. He's been on many times in the past, Dan Wojcicki from the LA Times, next on Smith and Jones. Welcome back to Smith & Jones. Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you. Subscribe to Smith & Jones wherever you get your podcast, Google, Apple, Spotify, or otherwise. Download, subscribe, rate, review, and share as we shift our attention from the East and New York to the other major market in the West and the LA Lakers. And it's been a grind thus far for the Lake Show to talk about that and more. We bring into the conversation right now, as I said before the break, friend of the show. We always love chatting with Dan Wojcicki from the LA Times.
Dan, always great to have you on. I want to start, since we're talking about the Lakers, and there are always nothing but grenades thrown when we're discussing the Lakers.
Yeah.
How about Anthony Davis lobbing that one over the fence? We look disorganized. We don't know what we're doing. And Darvin Ham kind of jumping on the grenade, talking about his coaching staff and how well prepared. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle. I think AD probably feels that they're not organized, and Darvin is probably right with there's some frustration. But what did you take from that comment? Because we don't hear a lot of that from Anthony Davis or guys calling out a coaching staff down 2-0 in the playoffs.
Well, so I feel a couple different ways about it, to be honest. I think. I think it would be foolish to assign direct line blame to sort of like who's responsible for the Lakers not knowing what, like looking like they don't know what they're doing, right? Like, I mean, that's coaching, certainly, but that's also players,
yes,
too, right?
Yes.
And I think that message from Anthony Davis, I think, was intended at multiple targets. And that comes from a guy who took one shot in the fourth quarter after playing as good of a half of basketball as we've seen anybody play, in this postseason, on both ends of the floor. I think was 12 or 13 from the field. He was guarding Nikola Jokic, had a little foul trouble, but I mean, was really doing everything he could have wanted. And they, the Nuggets made a switch and then they went away from Anthony Davis. Frustration with the coaching staff, I'm sure, but also frustration with the fact that no one passed him the ball in the fourth quarter too. Right. And he's a guy that's as a backline defensive player has always kind of been frustrated when things don't go well on the defensive end. And, sure enough, Denver scores, eight of their last nine possessions made their last seven field goals that they attempted. So, yeah, I mean, I think it was frustration. I think it was coaching. Do I think it was a full-on direct call-out? Not necessarily, but I mean, I think it's cumulative, right? These are the kinds of things you say and feel after you lose that game to a team that's beaten you nine straight times previous. You feel a certain way about it when you lose that way, especially, too, when you're AD. And you're the guy who has to watch the celebration happen inside your jersey, basically, from the Denver bench.
Yeah.
I think it was a lot of factors. This has been a fairly together team, a fairly mature team when it comes to this stuff. I know Darvin Ham is a guy who has a very open door when it comes to, criticizing, let's talk it out. I would expect them to be pretty together tonight.
Dan, you might have just answered this at least in part, but I'm asking the question anyway. Is the call out, is the criticism even fair/accurate? Because the flip side is, and I've never been one that's being accused of being too positive. I'm more the glasses half empty guy.
Eric, you love firing Laker coaches, by the way. This has been longstanding thing for you.
That
right?
is true. I'm kind of defending Darvin Ham here.
Look at you.
What I'm saying is, you had leads in both games. You had a double-digit lead, and it looked like, I don't know that you were running away and just that game was over. Clearly it wasn't. But that looked like that game was over. And obviously, ifs and buts and candies and nuts and all that crap and cliche, down the stretch, if Denver doesn't do what they do in the final 25 seconds, let alone the final literal seconds to win that game on the buzzer beater, it's 1-1. And are we hearing any of this from Anthony Davis?
No, but I do think, though, there has been a... There's been a frustration over the last year plus. Just that at times the Lakers are just sort of slow when it comes to in-game adjustments. The Darvin is sort of slow when it comes to in-game adjustments. Loyal NBA fans will remember this was very much a Mike Budenholzer issue as well, right? Who is Darvin Ham's, I don't want to say mentor, but the coach that he worked for a lot of years prior to this, which is you have a system, the system is working, you don't want to go too far away from the system. You know, the same plan built you a 20-point lead, you know, let's not panic. And I think that it is a fine line. I do think the Lakers and their coaching staff need to be more nimble when it comes to making tweaks. Like, I don't know if you need to full on abandon systems or something like that, but like you certainly need to make changes and you need to make them more rapidly and read the game in that way. But there is something to be said for the work that you put in prior and you know, an execution element. Like I think this is a scenario where multiple things can be true. And I think, yes, the Lakers offense in both second halves has been just a disaster, especially in game 2 after Denver makes a switch. But Rui Hachimura missed like 3 layups. LeBron James missed like 2 layups. You make 2 of those and you win. Like layups.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like not. And so if you're creating, so on one hand, yeah, like you'd like to see like them be a little more creative, get the ball, but also they were creating good shots and they were creating good shots and they were missing them. So where does the responsibility lie? Again, I think it is not a straight line. I think that this is something that is almost more like an oscillating fan of blame that's just kind of pointing in a bunch of different directions. But credit to Denver. This is the pressure they put you under, particularly in this matchup. Everything feels so pointed. Everything feels so important. And everything feels like such an indictment of what you are and what you aren't. When you play a team that's this sound, that's this good in the clutch, that, you know, I mean, I don't think I ever really thought Jamal Murray was going to miss that shot. I just sort of, you know, like I've seen the movie enough that I kind of feel like, oh, it's a big shot. It's late in the game. Denver's going to make it.
Yeah.
Because they always do.
Dan, the Lakers are in such a tough spot now. You're basically a team that's beaten you, you know, I don't know when the last win was, like 10 in a row or something.
10
like
straight.
That.
10 straight. It was,
And now you got to, if you're going to advance, you've got to beat them 4 out of 5. And one of them mm-hmm. still has to come on their court. And I look at the psychological part of it. And there was a school of thought. I don't know if they can come back. I really, really don't. 2-0s are tough to come back from. And that's a psychological part. And then, Dan, there was the other part where I'm never a proponent of this, but people were saying, well, the Lakers should have lost the first play-in game to avoid Denver.
Yeah, I think that's crazy, Jonesy. I think that's just crazy.
Yeah, I don't ever, like the basketball gods don't work like that. Don't mess with the game. But, you know, you look now and you think, well, is that something that they should have considered? I'm going on record. I'm like, no, never. If you're going to win, you're probably going to have to beat Denver at some point and not wait for somebody to do it for you. So take the bull by the horns and listen, this series could very easily be 1-1 right now.
Yeah, Josie, it's interesting. I mean, I think when it comes to that, I mean, I'm very staunch that, like, if you wanted to avoid Denver, like, you take care of business against Brooklyn when you're up 18 at home in December. And you blew that game, right? Like, right. Like this is the bet that you have made yourself over the course of an 82-game season. There is one, like, I find it to just be, like, sort of, like, competitively dishonest to lose a play-in game on purpose. But then also, like, look at what happened in these play-in games. Jimmy Butler hurt. Zion Williamson hurt. You know, like, don't put yourself in that position. to like where you can show up at an arena and somebody pulls a hamstring and then you're out of the playoffs altogether, right? Like to your point, I mean, they are some fairly easy execution pieces away from being 1-1 in this series. And quite frankly, guys, if they played a good game, not even a great game, a good game in game one, maybe even 2-0. Like they were in position, you know, twice in Denver. Now, the crazy part is somehow I think that makes it worse and makes me like their chances even less. That they've been so close and they've been like not able to like get it across the finish line, right? It's like they're like a great football offense that has no goal line presence. Like they're like it's kind of like they just can't do it against this team. But they're there. I think that's why tonight is such an interesting game, because how quickly the narratives can and will flip should the Lakers win. If the Lakers play well again defensively and win this game, they will have been the better defensive team for seven to 12 quarters in the series. They will have been the team that has done a fairly good job on Jamal Murray, all things considered, the team that's done a fairly good job on Nikola Jokic, all things considered, you know, and kind of really had two real clunker offensive performances, especially, well, one and a half clunker offensive performances. You come home, you make shots. Rui Hachimura plays the way that he's played all season. Austin Reeves shoots the ball the way he shot it all season. D'Angelo Russell has another good game. You have real momentum going into game four, to where if you even up that series, and now you are looking at a situation where you have to go to Denver to steal one, you've almost already done that. What's crazy about this series is that if some version of this happens again, or if the Nuggets hit threes, which they haven't really to date, you're staring a sweep right in the face. This is not a series for gray areas. Everything feels very, very, very sudden, very drastic. And that's why it's been so much fun to write about and cover.
Dan, what's the attitude like around the team? You are close to those, yeah, the team, those guys. And I mean, a lot of you guys that cover the team with the Lakers because of LeBron and, you know, the nature of covering LeBron, you've got to have your antenna up. Sure. Do they feel like they can come back, or is this kind of like, man, like we are throwing the kitchen sink at these guys and we still can't beat them?
On one hand, I think there is undoubtedly a mental component in play here. I've heard players say some version of, man, like, why can't we beat these guys, or we just can't beat these guys, as they throw their hands up kind of in the air. I think every time they have felt that way and then watched film, they have felt that the gap is smaller than maybe it feels like, you know, because of the kind of easy-ish to correct mistakes that they've made. Now, I don't say that disrespectfully to Denver in any real way. Like, part of what Denver does is they make you feel like you have to play perfect basketball when you feel like you have to be perfect. I think that, especially in basketball sport, where you need to be free, like you have to walk this really fine line between like confident and free, but also like not careless. Denver really makes that line even thinner, with just the pressure they put on you, the fact that their best player is always doing the right thing, really. Denver, I think, deserves some of that. But I mean, look, I mean, you just can't smoke layups. You know, you just can't. You can't just turn the ball over recklessly in the ways that the Lakers at times have turned the ball over. And I feel like if you just like, you know, if you go from 13 turnovers to 9, if you go from 5 missed layups to 3, you probably win. And I think they felt that way coming out of film. So I would anticipate another pretty confident performance. I think the tricky part, the X factor, is like, Denver also hasn't like really fired like a huge haymaker yet. Like, even the comeback in game two wasn't like a Golden State Warriors, even Denver last year style comeback, where it's like three-pointer, 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 three-point play, three-pointer. Like, it wasn't like that. Like, this was like cut the lead by
get it from 20 to 15, and then it hovers around 15 for a couple minutes, and then it hovers around 11 for a few, and then it's 8, and then it's 6. You know, it wasn't as sudden until very late in the game. So, you know, I do think Denver has that kind of, like, knockout punch that they haven't fully thrown yet. We'll see how the Lakers withstand it if they come out and Jamal Murray's hot and has a 15-point first quarter. If Michael Porter Jr. makes 4 or 5 threes in the first half, you know, can the Lakers hold it together then? But, you know, to me, if Denver is the same kind of offensive team they were in the first two games, I'd anticipate the Lakers to again have another really good start and then again be really tested with their discipline and with their ability to kind of counter to whatever Denver does in response to the success the Lakers have.
Hey, Dan, we had Monica McNutt on earlier in the show from the Knicks broadcast, and I asked her a similar question I'm going to throw to you right now. I acknowledge there's no way for you to actually know this one way or the other.
Okay.
But
well, my favorite kinds of questions, Eric.
Yep. I know you love it. But it's good food for thought. I asked Monica about good, bad, or otherwise. What if the Knicks didn't make the deal involving a starter and their sixth man in Quickley and Barrett coming to Toronto for OG Anunoby and Precious Achiuwa? The Laker version of that is, as aggressive or unaggressive as they were, should the Lakers have done more to try to add to what they had or have at the deadline? Yep. Was there something that you're aware of that they could have done that they didn't do, or did they need to do something to improve upon their team going down the stretch, let alone where they stand right now in the first round?
It's a good question, Eric. I think that, you know, in terms of, I mean, the name you heard most was like DeJounte Murray. It never really sounded like there was any real there in terms of those two teams in a deal, right? Like, you know, for the Hawks to like truly consider it, the Lakers are going to have to include Austin Reeves, and they weren't interested in doing that. Austin Reeves is a third-year player who they think plays winning basketball, and he's on a great contract, right? Like, so they not interested. It would have been more like, you know, should the Lakers have been more aggressive in trying to pursue, say, like Royce O'Neal? You know, should they have been more aggressive on the backup big market to get, like, you know, another kind of like hefty center that they could credibly throw at Nikola Jokic? Like, should they have pushed really hard for Andre Drummond, you know, or something like that? But like, the Lakers are in a weird spot, guys. Like, they have real limited assets. It's not like they're overflowing with exciting young players, you know, and they have sort of the good fortune and sort of the curse of having LeBron James in year 21 at age 39, which is like, he's the most win now player ever. But at the same time, like, you'd be foolish if you're not thinking a little bit about tomorrow too. So if you're going to cash in all of your assets, which was like sort of the discussion points, right? Like, do you push all in for Dorian Finney-Smith, you know, or some version of that, you've got to be pretty sure that that's the kind of move that's going to get you over the hump. And I don't think there was a hump mover at the trade deadline for them. I just don't think there wasn't like an Anunoby style deal for them to be made.
But Dan, when I think of it, and you know, you're so correct. You do business with LeBron, it's a different animal. It's, you know, you're walking that line of doing a deal with the devil, because you got to win right now. And if you win now, then you're going to the bottom of the pile to try and fight your way up. And if you don't win now, you're going to trying to keep win now. You're going to keep trying to win now and make those deals. And I would argue there's a couple guys on the injured list right now. I just saw the thing earlier before we came on with you that said, you know, they're out again today. Like, if you have a fully healthy roster, maybe a couple of those guys that are injured are the subtle difference makers that you need.
Well, I mean, a big part of the Laker plan this season defensively, like, did revolve around Gabe Vincent and Jared Vanderbilt. And, like, those guys, I think, played something like 24 total games in the regular season. I'm just guessing at that number, but that sounds about right. You know, that Vanderbilt came back right around, you know, early December and was out, you know, in February. Gabe Vincent played a couple games to start the season, had a knee thing. They tried to shut him down and rehab it that way. Came back, got hurt again, had to have surgery. Didn't return until the last week of the season. So, I mean, those were your sort of point of attack defenders. Now, look, how that, you know, Jared Vanderbilt, I think, and I've tried to remind Laker fans of this, for as valuable as he was last year in the playoff run and for how well he played at times after he returned from his injury this year, this is a guy who, you know, in game four last year, the Western Conference Finals, the Lakers down 3-0, Darvin Ham decided not to play because of the offensive liability, right? Like, he got played off the floor in that series. But I do think, you know, 15, 17 minutes a night, like having his sort of defensive thrust would make a real difference. I think one of the ways you'd see it, I mean, like, this stuff is all an ecosystem, right? So, like, if you have those guys out there guarding the best players, that means Austin Reeves doesn't have to chase Jamal Murray around, and that probably means Austin Reeves is a little fresher on the offensive end.
Right.
You know, like, that's probably how something like that, like, that's really where the impact goes, where instead of Austin Reeves being, you know, at 36% from three this year, maybe he's at 41. If he's not chasing Steph Curry and you know, taking on those kinds of defensive matchups sort of out of necessity. If Jared Vanderbilt was on the floor, if Gabe Vincent was on the floor more, like, that would give him, I think, some more help to do stuff like that. It would open things up for those guys. But, yeah, I mean, Jonesy, I mean, like, the Lakers, I mean, their plans didn't work out that way. But they also had remarkably good health from LeBron James and Anthony Davis. And I think given those two options, I think you would take the Stars, you know, 100 times out of 100. So it would have been nice for them to kind of see their vision of their team kind of come together. It never really happened. But it is, you know, like I said, I mean, I really do believe that it's, you know, it's a cliche and you hear guys say it, but I believe it. And certainly when you have LeBron James, you better believe it because he's done it three times. A series doesn't start till, you know, the home team loses.
Dan, I'm
right? That's just sort of.
Oh, sorry, didn't mean to cut you off. Yeah, no, you're right. That is how it works. I'm getting excited. I cut you off because I just had this idea pop in my brain that has nothing to do
all
with.
All right, what do you got? Fire Frank Vogel and do what? What's the plan?
No, that's in Phoenix now. They're thinking about firing Frank Vogel.
Hey, my guy Frank not looking so good right now, but hey, that's all right. I mean, they got time to put it around.
It's a cruel world, Eric. Yep. It's a cruel world out there.
I can see that, you know, it's L.A., so it's Hollywood. The script is, it's like coming into my brain now, Dan. The Clippers have long forever been in the shadow of the Lakers. And in the final year before they move to go into their own building, the championship is won by the Clippers at Staples Center. And then who knows if they ever win it again in their new building, but they close the chapter with a championship run. Could they actually do it? Or much like the Philly series and much like a lot of sports in general, is it dependent on health and specifically on one of their main cogs, if not their main cog, in Kawhi Leonard not being 100%?
Yeah, I think they're good enough. This is to me, I look at it, it's a championship coach. It's a championship roster. They have depth. They have size. They have shooting. They have defensive versatility, right? Like, what else would you want? As you guys know, you know, incredibly well too. Like, you have a player who is built for the postseason and built for big moments in Kawhi Leonard. You know, and you know, shout out Norman Powell too. But I think to me, I'm not overreacting to the loss to Dallas in game two. The first game back when you like reintegrate a big piece is usually a rough one.
Yeah.
It's not easy to do. You play a certain way and then you bring in another player and everybody wants to do the right thing. So you tend to overpass. You tend to walk a little bit on eggshells on the court. And I think, look, if he is healthy enough to keep playing in this series, and I haven't heard that he isn't. I mean, they're good enough, but I mean, I think this is true for the Clippers. It's true for the Lakers. It's true for the Mavericks. You know, it's true for, who else am I missing? The Phoenix Suns. There's going to be some really, really good players who have their season end in the first round in the Western Conference this year. It's just, that is guaranteed.
Whether or not it's a full-on sort of changing of the guard, it might be. But, like, there is there are going to be some names, and there already are some, that we're used to seeing kind of, you know, playing into the end of May, playing high leverage basketball that won't be. I think the Clippers have a better chance, certainly, they put themselves in a better position by, you know, where they finished in seeding, by who they're playing in the first round. But, like, you know, you've got to go take one now from Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving in Dallas, and good luck.
Yeah,
no, those guys are great players.
I always say, Dan, if you're good, you're playing after Mother's Day. If you're really good, you're one of two teams playing on Father's Day. I thought interesting comment from Chet Holmgren at the end of game two in Oklahoma City, where he pronounced SGA as the MVP. And
he is.
Canadian bias aside, when I look at what he has done compared to what Jokic has done, Jokic is fantastic. I don't know if there's voter fatigue, but to me, Oklahoma City lost in the play-in last year. They finished on top of the West this year. He's got a bunch of 20-somethings around him. He's like 30-point games. I just have to look and say, well, Jokic has Jamal Murray, and he's got Michael Porter Jr., and he's got a vet in KCP, and he's got, like, he's got Michael Malone.
They won the title last year.
They won the title last year. Like, and here's, to me, if I had a vote, and they took us away from the local guys for a number of reasons, but, I mean, Shea would get my vote. I have the feeling that Jokic is going to win it, which I don't think is right.
Yes.
But just your thoughts
on
the MVP.
I would vote Jokic. I would vote Jokic. And I don't vote. We don't vote at the LA Times. But I would vote Jokic. Similarly, in the way that I would vote, and when I did vote, I would almost always consider Greg Popovich for Coach of the Year. Like, just where I don't want to penalize sustained greatness.
No,
and
no.
I think I think you know, Shea's had an amazing season, and that season will be rewarded with either, you know, a second or third place finish and MVP, depending on where people are at it, with Luka Doncic too.
Don't start me on Luka.
Hey, you think I was hating on Frank Vogel? You get Jonesy going on Luka.
Do not start me on a guy that plays.
He's going to be all NBA. He's going to be all NBA first team. Shea, just like. It is the misfortune in my mind of, I mean, you have Nikola Jokic to me, who is, I wasn't covering the NBA during Shaq's prime. I've never seen anything like this. Quite frankly, like a player who is this all around gifted, especially offensively, but like even defensively is underrated with what he does with his hands. His size. I mean, like that really, look, if I needed a bucket at the end of the game, I'd feel really good about Shea. If I need a bucket, I think I'd still rather run any piece of offense through Nikola Jokic. And that's not, I don't mean that to be at all disrespectful to Shea Gilgeous Alexander. I hate that I'm saying this in my adopted homeland of Canada to the listeners. It really breaks my heart. I think it's a silver medal for Shea, for me.
Well, you're going to have to
spend a couple extra minutes
at customs and, you know.
Yeah, we've sent the the flag on that passport. W, capital W-O.
Can I tell you a quick customs story?
Sure.
Can I tell you a quick customs story?
Sure.
So as I was leaving Toronto.
Dan, as one former NBA player who played in Toronto called it customers.
They said, how much cash are you traveling with? And I'm like, I don't know. And they're like, no, but like, are you traveling with cash? And I was like, yes. And they're like, how much? And they made me open my wallet, and it was like $17. It was so humiliating.
The magic number
so
is
humiliating.
Yeah.
The magic number is 10K, Mr. Warkey. Yeah, if you ever
It was one of those things where it was like, I guess like I was a little flattered that I looked like I was like. Was caring to that sort of level, but like at the same time, it was so humiliating. And the customers just kind of looked at me and just sort of smiled and like, bless your heart.
Well under the legal limit. Well under the legal limit, my friend.
Dan, we appreciate it as always, man. Thank you for joining us, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Sounds good, guys. Be good.
All right, Dan.
That was Dan Wojcicki from the LA Times. Jonesy, before we go, I want to mention a couple of quick things. Three shout-outs specifically. I'm not going to mention last names because I don't know if they want to be mentioned on the air, so I'm just going to go by first names. But three women, and I know you know at least two, if not all three of them. One has recently battled cancer and has plowed through and is on the other side now. So shout-out to Danielle and for the courageous battle she's recently gone through. And two women currently battling and undergoing treatment, Grace and Bree. Just a shout-out to those three women all dealing with cancer. And hopefully, as I said, much like Danielle, the other two, Grace and Bree, come out strong on the other side as well.
Thoughts are with them, and it's a battle. And they certainly have the personalities, the capabilities, and the fortitude to fight that battle. So I'm very confident that things are going to work out and we're going to see them on the other side.
And I apologize if we're ending the show on a bit of a somber note in talking about this, but I hope it's actually more of an uplifting message to these three women, but also to pay respect and pay tribute to a gentleman that we all know. Even if we didn't know him personally, we know him because he's been in our living rooms and on our radios and on our televisions for decades, for generations. You know the name, you certainly know the voice of Bob Cole, who passed away on Thursday at 90 years old. And as fellow broadcasters, as a part of the brethren, I don't even know what else to say other than one word comes to mind for me, just legend. The man was an absolute legend, and his voice was just synonymous with sports, but certainly with hockey and with Hockey Night in Canada and tuning in on a Saturday night or in the playoffs and just hearing Bob Cole call the game.
First of all, condolences to the family and all of Bob's loved ones kind of soldiering forward without him now. Look, we've all been there losing loved ones. Hold the memories in your heart. And it never gets easier, but it just you look back with joy on the great memories. And Eric, to your point, in this business, it's the familiarity that breeds the comfort.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a familiar thing to turn on your TV on a Saturday night or at any time during the playoffs and hear that voice, hear Bob Cole. You knew it was big. You knew when it was exciting, he was going to rise to the occasion. He was going to make you feel like you were there and feel the excitement. And, you know, he's gone from us here, but those memories will live on. And, you know, as somebody who has been in the business a long time to, you know, I can just recall some of Bob's great calls and his voice and his intonation and hear the excitement. And what you got was a guy who loved his job. And he loved bringing other people the same joy that he had in the job. So, Bob, you know, gone from us now, but rest easy.
Folks, that's going to do it for Smith and Jones. We are going to continue with the show right up until the end of the postseason and knocking on the door of the draft, heck, maybe even the first week of free agency. We're going to be with you for the next couple of months. And as I said, to kick off the show, we've got our feet up with our popcorn, as Jonesy mentioned during the course of the show. We're watching as fans as well, but we will continue to bring you the goods for the next 8-10 weeks throughout the postseason and back every Thursday with fresh content right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and again on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks again to Dan Wojcicki and Monica McNutt for joining us, for producer and technical director Austin Mackey. For Paul Jones, I'm Eric Smith. Thanks for tuning in to Smith and Jones.